right at the hip. Blind as fuck and we start to slip. Toxic love.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Jalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from struggles for liberation from all around the world. Welcome.
Lee Lassiter from Prison Books Collective in Durham, North Carolina, a nonprofit project that sends zines and books to prisoners in Alabama and North Carolina prisons and jails, comes on this week to tell us about recent changes by the NCDPS to use the private company TextBehind to scan all incoming and outgoing mail, track their contents, surveil the outside users and mailers, and to make a profit on an already indigent population. We also talk about the work of sending literature to incarcerated folks, privatization and digitization of other services, and what literature gets rejected. More about the Prison Books Collective at prisonbooks.info. You can learn more about the organizing against mail privatization and digitalization by following the hashtag FreeTheMail on Twitter. You can also check out local books to prisoners projects in your area that you could get involved with by visiting prisonbooksprogram.org/prisonbooksnetwork. There are also a couple of really good articles from The Intercept about this and related surveillance services topics within U.S. prisons and jails. One is entitled Prisons Across the U.S. Are Quietly Building Databases of Incarcerated People's Voice Prints by George Joseph and Debbie Nathan from 2019, as well as Federal Prisons Switch to Scanning Mail in a Surveillance Nightmare by Lauren Gill from September of this year. Could you please introduce yourself with whatever name, pronoun, and affiliations you want to share?
Yeah, my name is Lee Lassiter. I am fine with any pronouns, and I mean that. I work with Prison Books Collective Publishing and Distribution, which is based out of Durham in North Carolina. However, I speak on my own behalf as an activist and an individual rather than a representative of Prison Books.
Cool. And could you talk a little bit about Prison Books, like how long it's been around and what y'all do?
Yeah, we started in 2006. I was not there then, but we have gotten in touch with some of the people who were involved in the original starting up of it. It started in someone's garage, and it has grown, although we're kind of in the equivalent of a garage still. But as I said, it started in 2006. It wasn't recognized as a nonprofit until about a decade later, but we have been able to keep it going. And we've just been sending books to North Carolina and Alabama and zines across the country for all of that time, really. And we meet every week to answer the letter requests and send packages out to people and talk to each other. It's not as anarchist as it once was at its roots. It's more service-based now. And there's a variety of like political opinions, but we still share the... Like, as a group, we still share the vision of alleviating the tremendous, cruel pressures of the prison industrial complex on the incarcerated people that we serve, and generally feel that incarceration in this country is done poorly and has overkill. And, you know, if we weren't needed, if our mission was served either by prisons or there weren't prisons to incarcerate people, we would prefer that. But while people are locked up, we get them all the books that we can.
And what kind of requests do you get? Like, is it for technical manuals, dictionaries, religious texts? Like, there's a lot of religious groups, for instance, that do outreach into prisons and send in materials that tend to have their specific, like, religious bent
and view on the world because they're kind of missionizing. What does it look like? What does the normal packaging party or packaging event look like for Prison Books?
In regards to what the event looks like, we just pick up the individual letters and start reading for what they request. Sometimes we do get requests for specific books and specific authors, but we work with a donated stock. So it's rare that we can answer someone's specific request with the exact book that they want. Sometimes it happens, though. And we just look around to find something, usually under 2 pounds, two books that we send, print off some zines and staple them, fill out an invoice, send our information, write a little note, and pack it up neatly and tape it up to be taken to the post office later on. We are requested, people request all sorts of books, the most common being a dictionary or a legal dictionary, and DIY sort of things and career books are often very frequently requested. A lot of people want to start food trucks or build their own houses or learn to weld or repair cars, do plumbing and carpentry, that sort of thing, which is extremely understandable for both jobs inside of prison and outside for whenever they get out. Those are, of course, also very hard to find often. We get a lot of requests also for coloring books and drawing books, a lot for thrillers and biographies and autobiographies of particularly African-American activists. And we have everything. So we try to send everything from classics to, you know, how to start your own business or histories about things, rock stars, biographies. It's whatever we can get, really. Yeah, so really, really a big variety. And as I said, the specificity of requests can vary from, please send me some books, or people misunderstanding our mission and just saying, I'd like to sign up for your book club. Just, you know, send me books every month. And we have to say, oh, you have to write in every time. We have a limit of how many books we can send, but you can request the kinds that they are. We have some publishers that reach out to us and will occasionally give us like a whole box of books that they want to donate for a cause, usually because of the subject matter has to do with prison or social justice. And we'll try to send those to the people who seem interested. But a lot of it is volunteers trying to read what fits their needs most, because we can only send so many so quickly to people. And of course, usually prisons only allow them to have so many at a time. So there's a little bit of art to figuring out how to get them what they want. I believe in the questions you sent over, you also asked what wasn't allowed, if you wanted me to talk about that.
Yeah, that'd be super helpful.
Yeah, so we mostly send to North Carolina state prisons. And this is true for Alabama prisons too, however, for the state prisons. And so tattooing, anything to do with tattooing is not allowed. Nudity is not allowed. They say, you know, artful nudity, like some Michelangelo or something would be allowed in, but in my experience, any nudity is not allowed because that line is gray enough that they just err on the side of, no, we're not going to let that in. Things that are gang-related or could enable crime in whatever way they interpret are not allowed in. And so that limits some of the things. Hardcovers are occasionally allowed in, but it depends on the prison. So we just don't carry them because trying to keep track of where we can send certain books is just a real time drain. Spiral-bound books usually aren't because people could take the spirals out and use them for whatever. And those are the main restrictions. But we still get occasionally weird bannings and rejections, very often from jails more so than state prisons. And then federal prisons are kind of at the level of state prisons in terms of what they allow. But yeah, jails have the worst policies, generally speaking, because it's just sort of determined by the sheriff, the warden in charge there. We've had, if you want to talk later about some of the rejections that we've gotten over the last couple of years. I can speak to that because I usually handle the appeals process as it exists.
Yeah, I would like to hear about that. I'd also like to hear though what. So I mean, you're filling a need. At one point, like I get a picture that at a certain point, maybe after, you know, maybe in the 1950s or 60s or 70s, that prisons maybe didn't always have, like, it depended on the prison, but prisons had a more robust, like, legal library for people to research their cases or, you know, for writing appeals or more literature, you know, like the, that at some point, education as a part of the quote unquote rehabilitation part of prisons was a bit more funded and a bit more focused. And so a project like yours, maybe unless a group had a specific ideological mission of like, we want to get more Muslim books in the prison, or we want to get more pagan books in the prison, maybe there wouldn't be as much of a demand. But that's changed. And I wonder if you could give sort of a sense, as you understand it, of what prisons' libraries look like and what prisoners' access to educational resources or reading for pleasure, like what access they have to that sort of stuff in North Carolina prisons?
I will try to the best of my abilities. I have not seen a prison library, but we hear about them pretty frequently. First, I should mention that during the COVID pandemic, which is still ongoing, libraries have often been shut down. We've heard that across the state, that various state prisons have shut down their libraries, or that sometimes they shut down visiting the libraries and then had a cart that they took around, but maybe the person who took the cart around died of COVID, and then no one is there to take the cart around. So some people have told us we are their only access point for getting new literature at this point. So right now it is in a particularly dire state in North Carolina. However, in general, prison libraries, I can't speak to the 1950s, but given the boom of the incarcerated population, I'm not surprised by the amount of need that is not being addressed by libraries in prisons, particularly legal need. We get a lot of requests where people are either suing the state or trying to appeal their own case or going through like other cases, and they have access to almost no legal help. They can't communicate effectively or to their satisfaction with their attorneys, if they even have one yet. They don't understand all the terminology or what they have to do. And we have an extremely limited stock. As you might imagine, paperback, up-to-date, specific, accessible law books are not widely provided and easily accessible by us. We try our best, and the number one thing on our wish list is always, like, you know, intro to, like, criminal law and like defending yourself. If anyone looks at the prison books wish list that we have up, but we go through those extremely quickly. People are very poorly informed by the system about their rights and the ways that they can appeal or sue and try to protect themselves. So that's unfortunately something we see a lot of, but that we, as just a small group of volunteers sending books for education and entertainment, don't really have the resources for. And there's a huge need for legal help within the prisons. As far as it's something that you mentioned before that I had forgotten was the religious outreach. I'll say that we do get not a huge amount of requests for spiritual and religious literature. As you said, there are lots of organizations willing to provide that. And no other kinds of books, but literature about that. We do get requests often for religions that do not have as many groups or are less represented inside of prison, like Rastafarianism, paganism, Satanism, that sort of thing, where you know, there's often a pastor inside of a jail or a prison, and you're not going to have that for like Rastafarianism or something. So that was something I wanted to circle back to.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're hearing our chat with Lee of Prison Books Collective about changes in prison and jail mail and book policies in so-called North Carolina and across the U.S. More info on their project at prisonbooks.info. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of stuff that that gets rejected. Like I've spoken with other folks that do books to prisoners and hear about like books by Frantz Fanon or books by George Jackson or Angela Davis getting denied because the content is, for instance, relates to prison and is critical of prisons. I don't know if that's the kind of thing that you see rejections for, but what sort of stuff gets kicked back to you and why?
I wanted to add a little bit of perspective on rejections that we had gotten and bannings. Firstly, just with out-of-state zines, because we send zines all across the country, just as sort of a glimpse into the reasons that institutions all over the country might reject things. One of the most recent rejections that we got was of our literary magazine, Words of Fire, which has publications of art and literature from incarcerated people across the country, and therefore we think it's very important that they also have access to read it all across the country, whether they are authors or might want to be authors. And we had a rejection in Connecticut of it because it was on printed paper and was not considered a real publication. And we've been doing several weeks of phone calls and some letter writing to try to appeal this because they are worried, quote-unquote, that having anything be on what looks to be easily printed or copied paper will have inmates calling their families to send them copied paper or printed paper straight out of books, and then the mailroom will be flooded and they won't be able to deal with all of the rejections and appeals of rejections. We've had it also rejected before from Florida when I was trying to get it to an author we'd publish, because it supposedly contained commercial content, which is incorrect, because we don't get paid for any of our services. And it also supposedly continued, quote, disallowed content with no descriptive of what that would mean. That was in 2019. Some of the other things that we've gotten rejected across the country include the GURPS, the General Universal Role-Playing System, which we send out. It was rejected from Texas for having fighting styles in it, which by the pages given was referring to, you know, rolling dice for hitting another character or doing damage or having a bomb go off as an example for this role-playing system's damage. We've also had rejections for supposedly, you know, promoting insurrection or posing a threat to safety and security and order for things like the Lectures on Liberation by Angela Davis. Florida is definitely one state where it's very bad to try to get things in. And we've had things like Tai Chi being lumped into martial arts, for example, over this. Some of the other bannings is that The Art of War has been consistently requested and consistently banned in North Carolina. It's not currently on the banned list, but we've still had so much trouble sending in the past that we haven't challenged it this year because of the number of rejections we've gotten over the years in the past. The New Jim Crow was one that was banned, but that was overturned in 2018 because there was national outcry about it, and that being overturned actually got them to redo their system of how they banned books so that they looked at it, the list again every year, and it actually overturned a lot of other things being banned, although you can tell from the banned list, including 12 Years a Slave and Malcolm X books and things like that, that they have not fully fixed the system, which, you know, some might argue shouldn't exist. A lot of our rejections, as I said, aren't bannings. They are actually just blanket blocks that do not care about the content that you are trying to send. For example, we had a jail recently just write, "We do not accept books on a package," despite having talked to them within a month about them accepting our books and having word given to us that they did still. Sometimes it just depends on who's in the mailroom. There's a federal institution in the state that just rejected something, and then when I called them, I was just told that was probably the other person. I understand where your packages are. We'll take them in. one instance in particular that's really been an odyssey over something like 3 or 4 months this summer into fall was there was a state institution which was allegedly having issues with drugs being smuggled in packages, so they cut off all outside packages and then reapproved vendors and distributors like ourselves on a case-by-case basis. And we had not yet been reapproved. So I called the captain and we had a few discussions, and he said he ran it up the chain and got us reapproved after a little less than a month. And then when we sent books to the people who had written that to us from there, half of them were rejected because those inmates in particular hadn't filled out a form and been approved to receive books. So we had to set up a system where every time we got a request, I called them, asked if that person was approved to receive books or not, and sent them. Except other than the two packages that we initially got into people, every time I called, the person was not on the approved list. And I asked whether, you know, maybe since they heard from us that we have requests for them and they want to receive books, you know, maybe they could get that form to the people that I was calling about. But they told me that was that's on them. That's their initiative and they should know. So that's been a pretty frustrating frustrating time. I've just had a lot of detention centers and jails in particular not consider us to be legitimate or not know what zines are or give us differing statements about whether we can get things in or not. As I mentioned, Durham Jail hasn't given us issues about us as a publisher, but was just blocking books for several months because of the amount of apparently extra material that was built up and was a fire hazard in the cell. So there's a lot of different obstacles to face in bannings and rejections that can't really be predicted and can apparently only be solved by weeks of phone calls. I hope this helps. Thank you.
Do facilities ever have an approved book list that's kind of the inversion of a banned list?
No, I have not seen an only approved books list, except in the case of one jail that sort of went back and forth on a policy where I was initially told, this was a jail, not a prison, I was initially told that they were going to be going to e-tablets and reading tablets and not allow in any books, but then any books besides the Bible or Quran. But then they said that was incorrect, and they would be allowing in certain books, but only new books, no used books, and also have e-readers. E-readers are a thing that we are extremely worried about. I say we, in this case, for all books to prisoners groups across the country, because a lot of that is a approved list of books. That is what that is. Working as functionally, because they have a catalog of books that they said, no, these are okay for them to read, and they will pay per minute to use these expensive, breakable e-readers and not have access to any other literature. So you can imagine people looking for, you know, specific legal help or niche interests, you know, for example, someone looking for Rastafarianism or something. There's probably not going to be a book about that listed inside of this e-tablet that they also have to pay to use. So that's something that is very concerning to us, because usually in the case of prisons, digitization and technological advancement, which can look like progress in the outside world, is not progress inside of the prison. For example, changing from having in-person visitation to having digital video visitation is not an improvement. Changing from having books sent in for free that you can request on any topic and having that be disallowed in favor of e-readers, that is not an improvement. Or, as we'll talk about in a second, having your letters be scanned and reprinted is not an improvement over receiving the letter. So a lot of times people will think, oh, things are going more digital, they're going more virtual and online. This is
advancement, this is progress. And in the case of prisons, it isn't.
Yeah, and it also, like, each of these steps basically shift the, whatever it be, the medical treatment or the books or the mail or the phone calls or the commissary, it shifts them into monopolies by specific corporations that are prison industry corporations, that not only are they siphoning money out of the prisoners and thus out of whatever, you know, supporters they have on the outside. And in North Carolina, they changed the law about 3 years ago where people can only get, at least on their JPay accounts for spending inside of prison, they can only have people with their on their visiting list. So therefore, like, people who have not, for instance, been convicted in some cases of felonies in the past. But yeah, a bunch of limitations. Anyway, but back on topic. As you say, you and I got in touch to talk about the changes to the North Carolina prison system that were kind of snuck in a couple of months ago. We got a letter from a prisoner in the middle of the state, just sort of being like, a heads up, like, I can't hear your radio, but I've heard of your project and this change is coming. Can you talk a little bit more about the privatization and digitization of prison mail in North Carolina and how it'll affect prisoners' communication with loved ones on the outside?
Yes. So on October 18th, North Carolina state prisons switched for all personal mail. That's letters, photos, and art and cards. They switched to having those be sent to the people they were intended for, incarcerated in state prisons, to having to send them to Maryland to be scanned by a company called Text Behind, and then have copies reprinted by the prisons and redelivered. The announcement of this was subtle. I only found it because I was on the state prison's homepage looking for something else and noticed a little pop-up that said the mail policy changing on October 18th and happened to click on it. Otherwise, we would not have known. I should admit this doesn't affect Prison Books operations so far, although we are worried about the possible ban on physical books being sent in. Right now, it affects the loved ones of incarcerated people who are trying to communicate to them. Text Behind is not alone in this, and there are a couple, not many, but there are a couple of companies who are trying to exploit this very captive market of people who are trying to sustain relationships across the miles and across the bars, and charging them money to either get their physical letters back if they send physical mail hundreds of miles away, because otherwise it'll just be shredded. So you have to pay to get that back. Or if you want to do it easier, of course, they have an app. For using their app on Text Behind, letters are 99 cents. You can add photos for 25 cents each. Greeting cards are 99 cents. And doodles for kids, so you can draw on your computer and send that, are also 99 cents. And that's only for partnered facilities. It's more expensive if the facility is not partnered with them. And you may not think that sounds like a lot, but if you are trying to keep up a relationship with someone or start a relationship with someone inside, then 99 cents a letter, 99 cents a card, 25 cents for a photo, that's very expensive. And if you are sending physical mail, it's a flat rate to get it back, I believe, at around $3 or higher to get that sent back to you. So this could add up really quickly, even if you just sent one letter a week or a couple of letters a month or something like that. People don't really have a choice in the matter if they want something that feels personal to be sent behind bars. And we just find this immensely worrying and honestly also unjustified, because the data, there's really almost no data provided for why this switch is being made, but we can talk about that in a second with drug policies. As a Prison Books volunteer, I have received countless letters telling us how important it is to have a lifeline to the outside where they can
they can hold on to that letter that someone else wrote and see their signature and look at this and say, someone out there wrote this for me and intended it for me. Not to mention if it's, you know, a kid's drawing or something like that, it's going to mean so much more if you're holding the crayon drawing that your son or your daughter or your child drew for you. And it's one of the things that sort of keeps them sane in there. If correctional facilities, as they're titled, were truly invested in making people more connected to humanity, kinder and more willing to invest in society, they would absolutely not be supporting this cutoff from the people who are trying to keep relationships going across the bars, because it's incredibly dehumanizing and, not to mention, probably riddled with errors. Wisconsin also just announced that they are using text behind as of December 1st. They put in their announcement that they've experimented a little text behind and there have been errors. They admitted of, you know, cut off letters where you can't read the whole thing. And I know from my own experience of, you know, keeping records from prison books that a lot of things don't scan so great if someone wrote in blue pen or on white paper with pencil. It just doesn't scan correctly. And the number of letters that text behind must be handling, I don't think that it's going to be a 100% accuracy rate, which will look fine on their numbers, but for the person who gets a messed up, you know, cut off or barely scanned letter or drawing, it's going to be devastating because that matters so much. The people who wait for the mail, that there's a huge emotional investment in it, and it's just really saddening to think about that being taken away from them. And not surprising, but extremely saddening. And unfortunately, it looks like North Carolina is going to be continuing that policy for the foreseeable future, despite so many people protesting it.
The Final Straw Radio is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
Ransom notes.
Anarchist and anti-authoritarian music podcast.
That's going to come out every month.
Ransom what? Ransom notes.
So what's like, I mean, what's your like ultimate goal, I guess, in this year?
We out for the
rising up against the oppressor.
The attitude that you see in hip hop.
Let me give you a sample of some of the lyrics that had some of the older ladies among the stockholders quite with dismay.
Good ransom notes. Hi.libsyn.com.
Or get them from the Channel Zero Network.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're hearing our chat with Lee of Prison Books Collective about changes in prison and jail mail and book policies in so-called North Carolina and across the U.S. More info on their project at prisonbooks.info.
So Text Behind is kind of a new project to me, but for the last few years, I've noticed that Pennsylvania prisons use a company in Florida called Smart Communications to scan and email their letters to printing on site at the facility. The Federal Bureau of Prisons, according to an article recently by Lauren Gill of The Intercept, appears to be moving forward from just scanning mail in-house to having a company called MailGuard do the same service for them. You've already mentioned this trend generally and the proliferation of private companies that are profiting from incarceration. And this seems to be rather frightening and growing pattern to sort of like capture that data and increase the costs.
Point communications is another one. And I just want to mention that the Pennsylvania ban initially also banned physical books, but there were enough protests that they changed that. So it's only mail right now. And so there's some worry from books to prisoner groups that the ban on mail is going to continue to try to ban books as well.
It's quite frightening. I have to admit that I'm not very knowledgeable about drugs in prisons, but I've heard that you can get many things if you have like money and resources inside of prisons, especially depending on what state you're in. But most illicit items I've heard about prisoners getting a hold of have come through corrupt guards and other staff as they shore up their personal accounts, because they don't get as much scrutiny as generally incoming mail or visitors and loved ones who are coming in. When PA started using smart communications, it was after mail staff, or, you know, screws on the inside, basically were supposedly dosed by letters containing the drug K2 in the paper. But then again, this other Intercept article about the privatization of prison mail references talking to a head of, like, a director of toxicology at a major medical institution in Pennsylvania. And that person saying, basically, like, you can't get high off of that. That's not going to actually, it's not like angel dust where it's going to just go into your skin by touching it. You have to increase the temperature and you have to, like, inhale smoke, basically, for that K2 to get into your system. So it seems like kind of a unrealistic expectation that was a major source of drugs coming in.
Yeah, so North Carolina, in their announcement about text behind, included a couple sentences saying, the new mail process will also prevent drugs from entering the prisons in the form of paper-coated in fentanyl, K2, Suboxone, or other dangerous drugs. These are hazardous to breathe or even to touch. This is something you would expect to have a citation. Doesn't. The only spot of data that is mentioned in the announcement of the switch to text behind is the sentence, in the year following use of text behind in North Carolina's four women's facilities, infractions for drug use and possession dropped by 50%. Now, 50% is a pretty round and impressive number, but there's a lot of missing context here. They say number of infractions for drug use and possession dropped, and they don't mention actual numbers, for example. This was also taking place during the pandemic for most of that year, because most of that was 2020, so the number of people in prisons across North Carolina went down by a lot. You might think that would potentially affect the numbers of infractions, not to mention the staff being able to, you know, investigate that sort of thing. And they also did not provide any numbers for cases of drugs causing any hazards to the people inspecting the mail. There's no citation for that. And, as you said, there's been medical pushback from people saying that K2 doesn't come into the skin. If fentanyl doesn't come into the skin. I looked this up a little before our interview, and the American College of Medical Toxicology and American Academy of Clinical Toxicology agreed in a 2017 statement that you can't inhale and get high from fentanyl without, like, a really high, really long exposure to it, and that you can't just absorb it through small, unintentional skin exposure. It would not affect people. So I am almost impressed by the boldness of NCDPS just stating that flat out as a reason without citation in their announcement. We have a Freedom of Information request that is making its way through the bureaucracy right now in trying to get any information about the hazards to people in the mailroom and how many drugs have come in through the mail. But I, like you, am skeptical about that being the way that most drugs make their way in. Texas saw, a ban on mail for the same reasons, but, you know, their drug infractions didn't go down because it turned out, they were mostly coming in through guards still, often because some people say at least that there's a connection between that and guards having, you know, lower pay, and they can make a lot on the side for carrying in drugs. I've even, when I went to a prison in person and got a tour when I was in college, was told by a captain that they mostly have to be careful about the guards bringing in contraband. That was just stated outright to the group. So this policy seems to be not only dehumanizing, but also not based on fact. And to make this huge of a change, there's a burden of proof
that they should make. But this wasn't a law. This was simply a new departmental policy. People started commenting on our social media post when we put this out, like, you know, let's call the lawmakers or something. But this was just something that was handed down and decided. And the fact that, you know, privatizing prisons and privatizing prison services is just getting more and more popular is very concerning to me, because these, like, they can't negotiate. And also just the poverty of incarcerated people and their loved ones on the outside is statistically much higher than the general population. So they don't really have alternatives than to go through these services. So that's my thoughts on that. But there are plenty of things to read about, particularly the drug claims here, whether it's investigating, you know, whether fentanyl can actually give you an overdose just from touching it, or where drugs come through. There's lots you can read online. And I suggest at least starting with the Prison Policy Initiative, because they're a good resource to keep track of the different policies going on around the country and their factual bases.
Yeah, that's super helpful. Thank you. So I do have another question about the implications of the privatization and tracking of mail coming in and out, but you did mention, you know, when people started commenting on your social media page saying, hey, like, call politicians, challenge it. The NCDPS is a part of the executive branch. So I guess you could put pressure on the governor and lieutenant governor, but like, how do you suggest that people try to apply pressure, whether they're in North Carolina, you know, or in any of these other states that are being affected by similar policies and some of the same corporations across the country?
Well, we haven't had success yet, is my addendum, but I would find at least one phone number, one email, and one physical address to call or to write to express your opinions. I've usually heard that phone calls are the best political weapon out of those three, but I know from personal experience that trying to get through the phone trees and the various extensions you have to press and voicemails you have to leave can be extremely confusing. So an email or a letter could also work. Prison Books is not, as an organization, calling for people to do this push, because we have to keep our services separate from this. However, I can say as an activist that I would love it if people started writing to, for example, the Commissioner of Prisons, Todd Ishii, who is quoted in a lot of articles about the letter digitization policy change, to express your opinion, or writing to the general NCDPS mailbox, which is the address of which is at the bottom of every page of the NCDPS website in Raleigh. So what you basically want to do is make it obvious that it's a lie to say people don't care about this, or that this is fine, this doesn't affect people. You want to get the voices that are shouting out individually to be able to unify and be heard together. And we're still working on that. But anyone who wants to be involved in the Free the Mail movement that has sort of started forming between Wisconsin and North Carolina activists, because we're both being affected by text behind in these most recent months, then they should, first of all, start looking through the hashtag of Free the Mail, and second of all, potentially email just to get the information where to go, prisonbooks@gmail.com. Prisonbooks is not organizing this, but has information of people that you can get connected with to try to organize something against this.
I have to say that hashtag is confusing and also very catchy, since a lot of us use the Free Them All, and those two look very, very similar.
Yeah, I would suggest, even for screen readers, you should be capitalizing letters for hashtags, because otherwise it's going to be a jumble of letters. It does look like that, but it was originally used, when I looked it up on Twitter to do a little research about it, it was used for like the Pennsylvania issue as well.
Oh, cool.
You know, there were some ideas thrown around of like, you know, don't jail the mail, but then we're like, well, it's prisons, it's not jails. That's, incorrect. You know, hashtags are going to leave a few things out, unfortunately.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and you're hearing our chat with Lee of Prison Books Collective about changes in prison and jail mail and book policies in so-called North Carolina and across the U.S. More info on their project at prisonbooks.info.
We've been talking about the limitations that people on the inside experience with their mail getting scanned and sent to them, and not being able to, you know, physically touch a picture that your child or that your sibling or whatever, you know, maybe drew, you know, getting an actual picture, these sorts of things, very sentimental, very like charged with emotional energy and feeling, smelling a piece of paper that someone else has touched. Like, prison's all about cutting people off from the outside and making money off of them. The other side of this, like, as you say, the majority of people that are inside of prisons or that are inside of a part of the carceral system tend to be poor. And whether that's because of survival crime or because people have less access to lawyers or bail to be able to get themselves out, to be able to make a better argument to avoid charges, or because police tend to hang out in poor people's neighborhoods, all sorts of reasons. And these industries like smart communications or text behind are literally siphoning money out of poor people's families when they're trying to keep those connections. Like, I deal with
GTA. And surveilling them.
Yeah, and surveilling
them. That's great.
Yeah. And like surveillance inside of prison, like the panopticon idea, that's pretty, you know, that's a pretty common idea. But when you download an app on your phone that you're paying for, and then it's, you know, there's the chance in this Lauren Gill article on the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and like talking about them switching over to this privatized scanning and emailing of letters, talks about the amount of metadata that gets also put into the database of that private corporation so that they can market more stuff at or sell that information if they want to another third party that provides others, like, quote unquote, services to prisoners. Or that information, you know, is also available to the BOP or to whatever prison administration there is for tracking and surveilling the person on the outside that's keeping track. Suddenly there's a permanent digital copy of this letter that somebody wrote to someone that could be used in some sort of case in the future or to build a case or something like that. Can you talk a bit about the, like, concerns of surveillance when people aren't even necessarily committing crimes, but just trying to stay in communication with friends behind bars?
Well, I think the article writer is probably more informed about that than I am. But I do know that text behind on their services page does advertise, you know, a variety of their sort of investigative tools. And that includes, you know, communications monitoring and looking for, like, gang connections, and they keep the records and not just the pictures, but the scanned text and, you know, the addresses of and names of those who sent mail in their system for years to possibly give away to other prison systems, the federal system, things like that. Yeah, they're sort of using the people that they already have under their thumb and can watch with this panopticon setup to extend surveillance outside and try to make connections and, you know, look for patterns in a way that they probably think is, you know, very efficient, but which is frightening to any of us who are concerned about our right to privacy. But because it's a human connection to people who are incarcerated being held hostage, people are going to have to make the choice about, do I, you know, want to be able to talk to this person, or do I not want to be put on a list of, you know, possible contacts and, you know, a third or fourth party to something that they are, that they think exists within the prison system. And having to choose between those two is, that's not a choice that should exist, that should not be something that writing a letter to someone, you know, starts for you. That's very concerning. Yeah, I'm always concerned about the privacy of people, you know, incarcerated as well, but I think a lot of people maybe aren't aware of this sort of extension
of surveillance to those who are just in contact with and care about the people who are incarcerated. As you mentioned with the J-PAY's changes, you know, now you can't send money unless you're in the visitation approval, and that requires, you know, getting approved, but also, you know, giving them information about you. And so it's really getting this data harvesting and surveillance hooked into people on the outside as well.
Well, is there anything that I didn't ask about that you want to mention or that you want to broach as a subject, Lee?
I would like to mention for, you know, people who are looking for what they can do, that jails are often where a lot of bad policies will be implemented first because they have far less oversight. They're county institutions, so they don't even have, you know, the state looking out at them. So if you are concerned about privacy, education, cruel and unusual punishment, pay attention to your local jail, the sheriff, the warden, their policies. And if they make changes like, you know, no one can send books here anymore, or, you know, a lot of jails in North Carolina, you now have to send your letters to Texas to get scanned, call them and deluge them, because they have even fewer resources to dedicate to supporting, again, the lie of, well, what I suspect to be a lie of the danger that letters pose and that books pose. So, you know, vote in your elections, vote for a sheriff who has concern for incarcerated people, if that's possible, and keep an eye on your local jail, and then also keep an eye on, you know, state policies. But if you want to start somewhere local, that's where to start.
And if you're not much of a voter, there you can still apply pressure during the period when there's more scrutiny on what sheriff is running for office. Yeah, that, I mean, that's like that, or like if they're working with ICE, are just a couple of the, you know, a couple of the push.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone who's closer is easier to reach and to, you know, make some noise when you can, when these policies get implemented near you.
So I know that, like, or my understanding is that a lot of the Books to Prisoners projects are pretty independent, and they kind of keep in touch with each other and share news and share, like, resources from time to time, or, like, you know, the project that you're involved with covers parts of, you know, it covers North Carolina and Alabama. The prison books here, actually, I can't even speak to what APBP covers. But they're not, they, for the most part, don't cover national stuff. And they sort of, like, pass off things in other states to people that are closer to them. Transmission Prison Project covers a lot of the U.S., but mostly is in the Southeast, as I understand. How can people find a Prison Books project where they're at if they want to start getting involved in this sort of way?
People can find local Books to Prisoners groups by looking at prisonbookprogram.org/prisonbooknetwork and searching for their state. If there isn't one serving their state, then perhaps they can start their own. It's not that difficult, and contacting really any of those listed on the directory will get you some advice on how to start up. And luckily, books are something that a lot of people want to donate. It takes not as much effort as you might think. I would say particularly X Books in Georgia started up about a year ago and have been doing very well, and probably have a lot of advice for newcomers. For supporting us, and particularly for Prison Books Collective, I have to say probably what a lot of nonprofits say, which is that money is the first need of us, and postage in particular is what costs us money, sending those packages out, and every year the rate goes up. So if you have money to donate, donate it. If you don't have money, then give us your time if you can. We just started accepting volunteers again, as long as everyone is vaccinated and masked, and we are still limiting the number of people that can come in. And if you can't do either of those, there's probably online work that you could do if you got involved, whether it's social media, applying for grants, reaching out to bookstores for partnership, helping with email. There's a lot of activism that you can do remotely that isn't just, you know, discourse on Twitter necessarily, but like actively working behind an organization to help them enhance their capabilities and do reaching out and things like that for them. Of course, we also take books for Prison Books Collective. You can email us if you have books to donate. However, I have to say we're doing pretty well in terms of books right now, and we have most genres pretty well stocked, but as usual, law and DIY stuff is always in demand. If you have any books on homesteading, farming, fishing, or, you know, trying to appeal your case in court, then send them our way. We have a P.O. Box, P.O. Box 625 in Carborough, North Carolina, 27510. You're welcome to reach out to us on our Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or through our email at prisonbooks@gmail.com to ask us for more things you can do. There's a lot, and a lot of people have come in with new ideas that have been very exciting to us. And so we hope that people can engage remotely or in person again, because we are an organization that works as a collective, and we're only as strong as the collective is. So we're excited to have new people join us. And of course, I personally would, you know, advocate for everyone to just keep their ears and eyes to the news and look for a variety of news sources, not just the mainstream news sources, about what's going on, and to advocate for the destruction of the prison industrial complex as we know it. Thank you.
If you appreciate the work that we do here at TFSR and want to support us, there are a few easy ways. You can follow us on social media and share our content online and with folks in real life. You can rate us on Google and the Apple Podcast to make our content more visible to more people. You could have a discussion around a topic of one of our interviews using either the audio or easily printable transcript. You could send a zine of an episode to a prisoner or leave it in a public place for someone to randomly come across. You can support our transcription efforts by getting merch off our website or subscribing to support us via Patreon, PayPal, or LibraPay. If you have the skills and the interest, you can translate any of our interviews or use the content from our project for your own. Finally, you could get a local community radio to air our free weekly radio version of this show so we can reach more ears. Info on all of this is in our show notes and at our website. Thank you much. And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We're caught like a bomb! So before I get to this week's topic, some fun facts to prove to you just how prescient I am. First, there are now hundreds of ships stuck in a bottleneck off the coast of California that are causing havoc with the U.S. supply and distribution chains. I talked about this on The Final Straw at its inception and predicted how catastrophic this would become. And here it is. Second, more people quit their jobs in the last month for available data than in any month since they've been keeping track. You'd recall me talking about this on The Final Straw before it happened, suggesting that the COVID lockdowns have many people no longer thinking of their occupations as their identities, and how this will prove dangerous to the economic order. And here it is. Third, the slow creep of inflation continues, just as I predicted on The Final Straw. If you remember, I also said that when inflation reaches a certain threshold, folks would simply start looting rather than paying, and that would be the beginning of a serious crisis for civilization. And here it is. So the combination of these three factors, the breakdown of the distribution process, the mass exodus from the job market, and the slow creep of inflation,
now lead us back to another topic I covered once before, flash robberies. Flash robberies have long had my enthusiastic admiration. They're disruptive to the hierarchical disorder. They're a great way to acquire necessary resources cheaply and with very little risk. And they're just good, clean fun for the whole family, and maybe even 100 of your closest friends. Flash robberies are a harbinger of systems collapse. As we see this strategy proliferate...
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Bonsoir tout le monde, c'est Alex qui vous parle. Vous êtes sur les ondes de CKUT. Il est 18h et vous écoutez votre émission d'art et culture préférée du vendredi soir, l'émission Café. Je vous parle depuis mon studio maison un peu plus tôt dans la semaine, mais lorsque vous allez m'entendre, nous serons vendredi le 10 décembre. Et je sais pas pour vous, mais pour moi, le temps a tellement passé vite, j'en reviens pas qu'on soit déjà rendu à la mi-décembre. Et d'ailleurs, parlant de temps qui passe trop vite parce qu'on fait les liens qu'on peut, il reste une seule journée pour participer à la campagne hashtag soutenez vos scènes lancée par l'Association des scènes de musique alternative du Québec, mieux connue sous le pseudonyme SMAC. L'association a donc déployé une grosse campagne de sociofinancement un peu plus tôt dans l'année dans le but de participer à la relance économique du milieu des arts de la scène alternative qui a été vraiment durement touchée par la pandémie et qui a encore beaucoup de difficultés à se relever de celle-ci. Elle n'est pas encore terminée et elles le sentent encore. Donc, pour contribuer, c'est vraiment super simple. Vous n'avez qu'à visiter